Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right.
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumi ayıktay The Fifth Floor farnak amidi sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. What will you do for love? On this episode of The Fifth Floor, we are going to talk about love and the high price some are willing to pay for it. Yulia Navalny and her husband, the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny, met in 1998. It was a chance encounter. He noticed her through the window of a tour bus. They were 22 and fell in love. For over 20 years, Yulia stuck by him. She was at his side when he was poisoned and fought for him when he was in prison. On the morning of February the 16th, Yulia was getting ready to give a speech at an international conference. A message pinged on her phone. A news flash. Her husband was dead.
I guess you all have already seen this horrible news coming from Russia. I was thinking for a long time, what should I do? Should I go here or should I fly straight to see my kids? But then I thought, what would Alexei do if he was here? And I'm sure that he would have chosen to be here, to come to this stage.
Since then, Yulia Navalny has become a symbol of Russian political opposition. BBC Russia's Natalia Zotova has been following the Navalnys. I began by asking her about their relationship.
In Russia, it's not very common for politicians to show their wives to the public. On the contrary, it's common for them to have like wives, lovers, secret affairs and stuff. And all of that is just rumors. But to show the wife to the public, that's in Russia, it's perceived as a Western tradition, as like as an American president showing the first lady to the public. So what Navalny did, I think he was following the American tradition of showing his wife to the public. So Yulia, she showed the people, yes, I exist, I support this man. Of course, she's very beautiful and it may have some influence on the audience too, you know. So like this strong opposition politician also has this beautiful wife and this nice family. They have two kids. And sometimes Navalny, when he was on a rally talking to the people from the stage, he would call Yulia to join him and they were both there. And sometimes even the kids.
Was she politically vocal as well? Did she have her own political views?
Well, we understand now that, of course, she does. I don't think any woman would bear this life with all those arrests and searches by police and all this hardship. unless she had the same goal, the same ideas. It's also clear that for Navalny, his work was his life, this fight for better life in Russia. So, of course, he talked to her about it. Of course, they were speaking about some ideas, some ways of solving the problems together. So, of course, she wasn't just a wife who cooks dinner. That's not who she was.
Yeah. So, when Navalny died, was it expected for Yulia to step in? Is that something you see among the political dissidents in Russia? Is it a pattern?
Well, in terms of Yulia, I think this was a surprise because she was asked to step in his place before, like when he was at risk of going to prison or when he was denied from participating in the elections. Some people said, like, why don't Yulia go? But she always said, no, I have to keep my children safe. I have to keep their lives normal. I think her idea was that he was the leader and the focus should be always on him. But now the situation fundamentally changed because there is no more Alexei. And then she decided to step in.
So recently, Time magazine did an interview with Yulia Navalny. She's on the cover of the magazine, a very striking photo of her as well. And as one of the most influential people in the world, what do you make of that whole thing, the whole one of the most influential people in the world title for Yulia Navalny?
I mean, she's not influential, like she can change laws in Russia and stuff. But many people is looking up to her, is looking what she's going to do, what she's going to say. In this sense, she's influential, sure. Like Navalny was, even when he was in prison, like, and everyone was waiting for his letter from prison. What will he say? What will he suggest? What should we do when the presidential election come? Please, Navalny, tell us what to do.
So what do you think that might mean for Russians when they see such a cover?
I think those Russians may be happy that the Western world is paying attention to the Russian anti-war opposition, to the part of Russian society that doesn't support Putin and doesn't support what is happening right now, what Russia is doing right now. With Alexei Navalny gone, Yulia is the most noticeable and the most significant participant of this group. In light of the war that Russia wages, some people, they say, like, all the Russians support the war. All the Russians are the same, because otherwise they would overthrow Putin, like, in a second. And Yulia is the person who basically tells everyone from the cover of the Time magazine that, no, not all Russians support Putin and war. And some suffered a great deal because they don't. In this situation that the Russian, like, anti-war part of Russian society finds itself in, there is not much to do. But it was just, I don't know, 3 days after Navalny died, and I heard Yulia saying publicly that she's going to take his place.
Я буду продолжать дело Алексея Навального, продолжать бороться за нашу с вами страну.
And what about when you read the interview? Was there anything she said that you think came as a surprise maybe to you?
I loved this part when the interviewer asks, did you go to the Russian consulate in Berlin to vote? Because it's Russian territory, so it might not be safe for you. Like, why did you do this? And she was like, when I know what's the right thing to do, I feel that I have no choice. I just do it. I thought that was also Alexei's way of doing things.
But it seems, Natalia, that there is this pattern among political dissidents in Russia that when something happens to them, their wives step in, which is not very usual when you look at countries, for instance, like in the UK or the US. Usually the political leaders, their deputies step in when they are gone. But we have that in Russia. These are the wives that step in to protect the legacy of their husbands. And there are a few examples. One of them is Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. What was her story?
Yes, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is a remarkable story. But first of all, she's from Belarus. And Tikhanovskaya became an oppositional leader there in 2020 after her husband, who was the initial oppositional figure, Sergei Tikhanovsky, he ran as a presidential candidate, but he was arrested. like many oppositional leaders were arrested at roughly the same time. But Tikhanovskaya entered into the race as a candidate after the arrest of her husband, and for some reason Lukashenko allowed her. Maybe because he believed that the woman could not like form a legitimate opposition. So the opposition, like the people of Belarus, actually united around her.
I was just wife and mother. I was bringing up two children and I was absolutely happy with my life. And now I'm going to find out if I will be registered as a candidate to president of our country.
There is no way to know for sure how many votes she got, but some countries like Lithuania, for example, acknowledge her as the president of Belarus.
As you were speaking out, I was thinking to myself, like, how much of that has got to do, like, you know, to show the power of loyalty as well? Because if these political leaders, their wives cannot be loyal to them and just leave, I mean, how can other people stay loyal to them? It is kind of showing the strength of the loyalty of people around them as well.
Yes, maybe it has to do with loyalty. Like you were talking about deputies that would take the place of the imprisoned or killed leader. But, you know, imagine some guy just stepping in the place of a universally recognized leader and telling like, this is me now, okay? I'm the new Navalny. Like, what? Even the closest Navalny's allies, they are also well-known in Russia, but they are getting a lot of criticism now. Some people say that they cannot represent Navalny. Like, that was many people's view even before the death of Navalny. But no one can say this about the wife. Like, the big love of a fallen hero who's experiencing a personal tragedy, but nevertheless wants to fight on. It's difficult to argue with that. Navalny and his wife, actually, what they had between them, we witnessed it for years, and it really, really looks like true love. They were in love with each other even after 20 years of marriage.
A true power couple, basically. It is a story that is more appealing than just a random deputy or another guy stepping in. You've written a piece about the wives of political prisoners in Russia and what happens to them, what their lives are like. And you spoke to a few of these women. Tell me about it. What is life like for most of these women?
You know, you were talking before about the thing with Russian wives. So there is indeed this stereotype in Russia of a heroic wife that goes through all the hardship with her husband and even after his death maintains his legacy. Like in 1825, some Russian noblemen revolted against the Tsar and most of them were sent to Siberia in prison or in exile. And some wives went along with them, even though they could continue living in St. Petersburg in luxury, like nothing happened, but they went to Siberia. And there is like a big myth around this. There were also the examples of writers' wives in Stalin times when the husband couldn't publish the books and then the husband would die, like in Bulgakov's case, he just died poor with no hope that his works will be published, and his wife kept all his works and published them when Stalin died. And the same goes for Nadezhda Mandelstam, the wife of Osip Mandelstam, one of the famous Russian poets who died in Gulag. She also kept his work. She even remembered some by heart because she was scared of keeping his poems in the house. That's how many poems saw the light of day. So yeah, this is not surprising that the wives of political prisoners in modern Russia devote their lives to helping the husband and to continuing what he started. I guess it's a tradition of sorts. But the interesting thing that I've noticed is that many couples of political prisoners have split up after these years of trying to support the husband in prison, and even sometimes even the husband is already freed and he came home, then they split up. And I started to investigate how is it happening and why, and turns out it's very hard on the woman too. The woman has to send food and all the things the man needs to the prison, because that's how Russian prison works. It's very expensive to have bearable conditions in there. So, like, the woman becomes the provider, the chief campaigner for her husband's freedom, you know, the spokesperson, the psychologist, the nanny, etc.
It's all consuming.
And, yes.
24-hour job.
Exactly. It's very easy to lose yourself.
Yeah.
At first, they dedicated everything to the husbands. And even they forbade themselves to, you know, go on a vacation or have fun because all the time is needed for the prison, all the money is needed for the prison. And by the end of the sentence of the husband, the women felt like burned out and exhausted. And yeah, there were many breakups. This was a very sad story that I had to write, that like love doesn't conquer all, you know. There are ways of killing the love, even if it's very strong.
Yeah. I mean, it's even hard to have a long-distance relationship in freedom, let alone if one of them is in prison. So, Natalia, your story is very interesting as well, because you had to leave Russia because of the work your husband did. He used to do some work for Alexei Navalny. When did you find out that, okay, I have to just pack up and leave?
So, the war... Russia's war with Ukraine started in 2022, as everyone knows, but things were getting really bad years before that. For journalists, for political activists, they felt growing tension. And in 2021, things became really bad. At that point, Navalny was already been poisoned, and then he returned and was put in prison. So the main opposition figure in Russia was already a prisoner, and the authorities started to persecute his allies, people he worked with. And basically one very sunny September day, we found out that they proclaimed everything he did extremism. So everyone who worked with him, even like years before, like my husband, was in danger of arrest because he's a suspected extremist. And yeah, my husband did work for Navalny. He was his photographer in 2017 when Navalny was trying to run for president in Russia. So this news about the criminal case came, and we were both working from home this day. And my husband came to me and said, like, maybe this is the moment when we go abroad, because many activists, many Navalny's allies were already abroad. They left. It was understood that they are not safe anymore. And my husband is a journalist, but still he worked for Navalny some years ago. And we thought, like, the police won't make a difference. We won't wait and see, like, will the police understand that he was, like, doing journalistic work or not? And we were like, yeah, no, let's not taking any chances there. And the idea of leaving the country, it was just natural. I spoke to those women who supported the husbands in prison, and I knew that, like, that it's terribly difficult for the husband in prison and the wife outside, and that I would never let this happen to us, because I know that, like, love is really, you know, delicate. Love is vulnerable. It's not something you crack walls with, you know, like, we're gonna hit it with love and everything will be fine. No, you don't hit anything with love. You cherish it. And that's what I thought. I knew that the love will probably not survive his prison sentence, and let alone his health, you know. It's Russian prison is terrible. So the idea to leave came very quickly, and it was the obvious right thing to do. Yeah, it was not easy, of course, and like, Moscow's my city. I was born and raised there, and it was not easy going somewhere, because you want to go somewhere, you want to live in a different country, but because you just feel unsafe. But, you know, just several months after that, Putin started the war, and many people had to leave. And now my story is just of the many, many stories of people, journalists, activists, and they all left, some without money and stuff. So now we are the part of this big wave of Russians who left and who are still maybe living Russia.
Mm. It's very difficult, and I'm so sorry, Natalia. As a journalist who had to leave my own country, and I've been living in exile for the past 15 years, I totally understand what you're saying. So it's been over 2 years now that you've left Russia. Any reflections?
Right now, most of the journalists who left Russia, they work, from a desk. You can see the action with your own eyes. That's difficult. I came to journalism because I could be in the center of action and actually see what's happening. Those journalists who are still in Russia, they're very brave, but the risks are high and getting higher and higher. And I don't think I personally would bear to live in such conditions and to work in such conditions. So I guess the decision to leave was the right one. And we still continue working here and telling the stories about Russia and Ukraine and like telling Russian people what's actually happening. I also left with my husband. I know many people who left alone because like they don't have a partner or the partner couldn't go with them. And I think for me, it was much easier because my loved one is with me. So like the home is whenever we're together, you know, the home is whenever we're cooking dinner and chatting. And so having your husband near you really helps in this immigration thing. I'm also trying to adjust here in Latvia and I'm learning the language and I'm trying to assimilate, you know, to integrate in the society. And that is also helping me like understand that the world is big. There are many cultures and it's so interesting to learn about the new things. And like I left one country, but I got like the world, you know, I can study it and I can find new people. And it's so huge. And that's the positive idea that I'm getting from this immigration and being here with a loved one. That's the most important thing. I would never think of like you leave, I stay. No, that's not our story. We stick together.
Natalia Zotova from BBC Russia. This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right!
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions, because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Farina Kamidi. Now, what if I told you this?
Iromaka Ejulaji Ariogu.
If you speak Igbo, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But if not, you'll find out in a moment. What you just heard is a popular saying in Nigeria. Ikechukwu Kalu from BBC Igbo has been telling me just how important these sayings are in his culture.
Proverbs is an integral part of the Igbo language. So Proverbs is like a red oil recipe used in eating yam. So you can't eat yam without using red oil. So that's to tell you how Igbo proverb is close to the language.
And I know that you are a proverb expert, so to say. And that's because you curate BBC Igbo's social media page. And every week you put out a picture accompanied with a saying. Tell me about that. How did that come about? Why did you start doing that?
The idea to use proverbs in making social posts in BBC Igbo is a collective idea of the members of the team to, you know, better relate with our audience. What we do is to cut it short. We don't write it in full. We just make few.
So it's kind of like a quiz.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Complete the quiz and then tell us the meaning.
Uh-huh. So you put a picture, and then you ask people to guess what proverb it is.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Nice.
Probably state the meaning of the proverb. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So can you give me some examples of some of them that were really interesting and just like stick in your mind?
Iromaka ejulaji are obu.
What does it mean?
Just for the purpose of this program, I will tell you, but in Igbo, in the tradition, you don't explain proverbs to people.
Uh-huh.
You don't come up and say, please, what's the meaning of that proverb you just used now? So it's kind of making fun of yourself. But someone can actually come behind the scene and ask me, please, can you tell me the meaning of this proverb? Okay. I will actually tell you.
So that's a proverb etiquette.
Yes.
In Igbo culture, I had no idea. That's fascinating. So even if I don't understand what you're saying, I will just pretend and just...
Pretend, yes. Mm-hmm. Then after everything, you can come behind the scene and ask me and I will explain to you.
That's good advice.
Yeah, but for the sake of the program, I will make some proverbs and I will tell you.
Yes.
Okay, we have the one we say, Iromaka ejulaji ariogu. So ejula is snail. So... use this tongue to crawl gradually through a stick that has thorns.
So a snail uses its tongue to walk through a stick with thorns. Okay.
So which means just move carefully to pass through a rough situation. Yeah.
All right. That's cute. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. What else?
Then there's this one. Ojingajeri. Chetakwandijaka. When you're eating with a silver spoon, you just have to remember those who are eating on the floor. So meaning as a rich person, remember the poor people to help them out. That's what it means.
So what is the reaction of your audiences to these posts? How do they engage? Do they really like it?
Of course they do. The Proverbs post is one of the most engaged posts. So they actually like it.
What about in your journalism? Is it usual to use proverbs in journalism as well? And if so, can you give us some examples?
Yeah, we use proverbs in journalism. So the essence is to bring the story down to the understanding of our audience. So there's a series we do, we call it Obambo. It has to do with entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're doing such stories, you can add a proverb like Akajaja nebute onomanomano, which means that if you don't hustle, if you don't work, you don't eat. So those entrepreneurs, they try to work, you know, they soil their hands to make sure that they have ends meet. So that's what it literally means.
So you usually open up with something like that to give the gist of what is going to be talked about. So, Ikechukwu, tell me about your favorite proverb. What is it? What does it mean?
I have a lot, but one of my favorites is Agbosi Baotele Omorako. So, Agbosi is a kind of ant, black ant. So, when it bites your buttock, you have to learn. You learn from it in life. You have to learn from experience.
Even from an ant bite on your buttocks.
Yes.
Ikechukwu Kalu from BBC Igbo. Proverbs just bring so much color into what you want to say. My favorite Farsi proverb is something similar to the snail saying in Igbo. Gar sabr koni zequra halva sazam. If you are patient, I will turn sour grapes into sweet pudding. Is there a saying in your language that you like to use to give people some life advice? Share it with us. Send us an email to thefifthfloor@bbc.co.uk. That is the fifth floor, all one word, @bbc.co.uk. And that's all from The Fifth Floor. I'm Farhana Kamidi, and the team this week was Caroline Ferguson and Alice Joya. The sound engineer was Giles Aspen. You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
another one bites the dust. Are you ready?
Hey, are you ready for this?
Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right!
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed, but whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment. Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.